Welcome back to Genocide Remembered, a Pacifica Radio special to commemorate the 90th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. I'm your host, Maria Armudian, here with co-host Lucy Dertavijan. We are joined now by Peter Balakian. He's professor of humanities at Colgate University, award-winning writer and poet, and the author of at least two best-selling books, The Black Dog of Fate, his memoir. It won the Penn Martha Albrand Prize for Memoir and a New York Times notable book. And he also wrote The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide and America's Response. Welcome to the show, Peter Balakian.
Thank you.
So in your book, The Burning Tigris, you describe living conditions for Armenians in the Ottoman Empire and other non-Muslim factions in the late 1800s prior to the genocide. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, to be Armenian in this case, or to be non-Muslim in the Ottoman Empire, meant that you were legally designated with infidel status. You were thought of as a non-believer, and the colloquial term was gavur, which was sort of a slang, a derogatory slang. Infidel status meant that you were relegated to a separate and not equal social, political, and economic status. Christians, for example, Armenians, for example, couldn't join the military. They couldn't join the civil service. They were taxed in a much more severe way, and in a way that really fleeced much of the agrarian community. They weren't allowed to own weapons. They weren't allowed to ride horses in urban areas. And they had no legal rights in Islamic courts of law. This was another way in which a property was extorted by Muslim overlords. Women were abducted, disappeared into harems and into slavery and so forth. So living with infidel status was very difficult.
Yeah, you quoted an ethnographer who said what it was like to be Armenian. He said they were dogs and pigs to be spat upon, if their shadow darkened a Turk, to be the mats on which he wiped the mud from his feet.
Yes, that was Mr. Ramsey, the British anthropologist and journalist who spent a lot of time in the Ottoman Empire in the latter part of the 19th century. Indeed, it was often difficult, and so Armenians in the latter part of the 19th century began to ask for some change, and that began to lead to trouble.
Can you get into some of that trouble?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to understand the Armenian massacres of the Armenians in the 1890s that were conducted by Sultan Abdulhamid II, and then the genocide of the Armenians that was implemented by the Young Turk government as the result of what I would call a civil rights movement. Christian Armenians asking for reform and change, organizing political parties, protesting peacefully in the streets, demonstrating, petitioning, and asking the question. In my opinion, they asked the fundamental question, can a Christian be the equal of a Muslim in the Ottoman Empire? And the answer was meted out very decidedly no, and then the no was expressed in wholesale violence and massacre. Interestingly enough, the first real conflict, I would say, or at least the first dramatic conflict between reform-oriented Armenians and their Turkish and Kurdish overlords was over taxes, where Armenians stood up and refused to pay the fifth round of fleecing of the taxes in that spring season in 1894. And when they were fired on, you know, they stood up. They didn't go away. They fired back. And that led to a wholesale massacre of what would end up as some 200,000 innocent civilians being massacred by the Sultan in the 1890s. The plan to exterminate the entire Armenian population, about 2.5 million Armenians living on their historic homeland of some 2,500 years, so that's important to understand. The plan to exterminate the Armenians was hatched by the Young Turk government, or better known as its political party, Committee of Union and Progress, that had taken power in Turkey in 1913, and the government was run by Minister of the Interior Talat Pasha, Minister of War Enver Pasha, Minister of the Marine Cemal Pasha. And the Minister of the Interior Talat was the mastermind, along with his high-ranking CUP officials, in a project to use the moment of World War I as a screen behind which to exterminate the Armenian population. And this was very well planned and organized. And I think that's important to understand, because the Turkish government today, in denying the Armenian genocide, would like the world to think that this was not organized. Well, this was one of the most efficiently organized genocides in history. It was carried out by a special bureau of the Committee of Union and Progress called the Special Organization, the SO. And the SO, under the leadership of Talat and one of his high-ranking bureaucrats, a physician named Dr. Bedahin Shakir, the SO established mobile killing squads to do massacring all over what is today Turkey, all over Anatolia and Asia Minor. And how were those killing squads created? They were created by the releasing of some 30,000 convicts from prison. Now, this takes a lot of planning and organization. I think it's important to note that emergency executive legislation was used. A temporary law of deportation was passed in May of 1915, and something called the temporary law of confiscation and expropriation was passed in September of 1915. And these parliamentary acts, temporary as they were, legitimized and expedited the government's ability to arrest every Armenian man, woman, and child throughout Turkey and place them on deportations, as they were called. But deportation meant massacre. It meant, really, death march. Technology was used. Armenians were put into box cars in the western part of Turkey. Cattle cars made for a dozen animals were stuffed with 80, 90, 100 men, women, and children. We think of that as only belonging to the Holocaust, but it really started with the Young Turk government in 1915. So these were some of the methods of organization. And so it's also, again, important to note that there was a very systematic approach to the Armenian population, so that the intellectual elite were wiped out often first. Professors, writers, poets, journalists, playwrights, community leaders were rounded up. And this, of course, is the event that Armenians worldwide use to commemorate the beginning of the Armenian genocide on April 24, because it was on that night in 1915 that about 250 intellectuals and community leaders in Constantinople were first arrested and sent on trains to the interior, where most of them were tortured and killed. And the idea here is, of course, that you cut the head off of the culture, you pull its tongue out. And again, it allows us to see the systematic plan in motion.
Now, you also gave this genocide a particularly important role in both world history and American history. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, I think it's important to understand the groundbreaking nature of the Armenian genocide. First, it really began the age of genocide, modern genocide. Genocide exists as far back as recorded history. We can find episodes and examples of race extermination. But modern genocide suggests the use of technology and state bureaucracy implemented for the purpose of liquidating an ethnic or culture group of people in a concentrated period of time. And the first time that was done was in 1915 by the Ottoman Turkish government against the Armenians. So that the Armenian genocide inaugurates modernity, the darkest side and chapter of modernity. The genocides that follow it all owe something to it. Adolf Hitler said 8 days before invading Poland in 1939, who today, after all, speaks of the annihilation of the Armenians. And Hitler, of course, was inspired by the fact that the Young Turk government had done what it had done to the Armenians. Secondly, the Armenian genocide is crucial to understanding World War I, just the way the Holocaust is crucial to understanding World War II. It was President Theodore Roosevelt who said that the Armenian massacre was the greatest crime of the war. Thirdly, I think it's important to note that the Armenian genocide really played an interesting, important role in the evolution of modern human rights and international law. And Raphael Lemkin, the man who coined the term genocide, did so in part on the basis of what happened to the Armenians in 1915, as well as what was happening to the Jews of Europe before his very eyes. So that the Armenian event is, shall we say, etymologically part of the evolution of the term genocide. And then, yes, you mentioned my point in The Burning Tigris that the Armenian Genocide plays an important role in American history, and it spawned the first international human rights movement in this country. And by that, I mean it's the first time Americans came together to go overseas in body, in person, to give aid and bring relief to a people who were being murdered en masse thousands of miles away. And really, the first international human rights movement in this country begins with the Armenian massacres of the 1890s. It's Clara Barton who takes the Red Cross overseas for the first time in February of 1896, and she spends most of that year with her Red Cross teams. She's in Constantinople, and the Red Cross teams are in the provinces rebuilding the Armenian economy. Americans spoke out in huge numbers, elite Americans, intellectuals, reformers, political leaders, as well as the broad populace, a grassroots movement. Julia Ward Howe, Clara Barton, I mentioned, Stephen Crane, William and Henry James, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, Theodore Roosevelt, William Jennings Bryan, Ezra Pound, H.L. Mencken, and so on, are among the voices that speak out on the Armenian issue over the course of four decades. And Americans also give enormous amounts of money through an NGO, well, many NGOs, really, starting in the 1890s, but the most famous was the foundation called Near East Relief, which in the end would give close to $110 million in aid for, as they were called, the starving Armenians. And if you tabulate that by today's currency, it comes to something like $1.3 billion. So we have this extraordinary outpouring from Americans, again, from Sunday schools and churches and synagogues, to major industrialists like John D. Rockefeller Jr. and Sr. as well, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegies, the Mellons, and so forth. So it galvanized a big piece of America for almost four decades, from the 1890s into the early 1920s.
Peter Balakian, I wonder if you could say if you think recognizing the Armenian Genocide today still matters. Also, before you go into that, the other thing I wanted you to add was the double killing aspect that you addressed with regards to denial.
Well, as I say, when any human rights crime goes unacknowledged by the perpetrator and unpunished, I think we have a grave kind of moral and ethical situation. Denial is a kind of ethical concept that scholars have developed over the recent decades, especially in the wake of Holocaust denial, and now even more dramatically in the wake of the denial of the Armenian Genocide by the Turkish government. When you have denial, you have, you know, a very serious moral problem, and scholars in the genocide community continue to reiterate that the denial of genocide is the final stage of genocide because it seeks to demonize the victims and rehabilitate the perpetrators. And it sends the message that genocide doesn't matter. It demands no moral accountability. And, of course, it encourages, it paves the way for more genocide to come. I think Elie Wiesel has eloquently used the term double killing to talk about how denial kills the memory of the event as well. And Robert J. Lifton has noted that in the case of denial, a counterfeit reality is created that attempts to rob the survivor population and the legacy population of the victims of moral order. So I think the Turkish government is being asked to deal with its past in a moral way, and that the more it engages in extreme propaganda of denial and hysteria, I think the more it impedes its own progress as a country that's now seeking to join Europe and become part of a democratic society. I think acknowledging past crimes is a very important part of democratic culture.
What do you believe the Armenian case has to teach us today?
Well, I think that the study of genocide first is important, whether we study the Armenian case, the Jewish case, the Rwandan case, or the Cambodian case. We are studying genocide so we can learn how the worst can happen, how the ultimate human crime can happen, and what we might as citizens do to understand why these catastrophes happen and how we might work to prevent. Obviously, the goal in studying genocide is also about prevention and about engaging us in action in the present. Anybody who cares about the Armenian genocide should be engaged in what's going on in Sudan today, in the Darfur region, should be engaged in the lessons of Rwanda and the Holocaust and Pol Pot's genocide in Cambodia, so that in the end, this is, of course, urgently about species preservation. It's about the ultimate issues of our survival as a human race. And the Armenian case has a lot to teach us. And as I've just noted, it has a lot to teach us about the importance of justice. A genocide denied by an unrepentant government, as the Turkish government is today, creates a grave moral problem and a demon that won't go away, for not only for the perpetrator and the victim culture, but really for the world.
Peter Balakian, thank you so much for joining us. Peter Balakian is a professor of humanities at Colgate University and the author of Black Dog of Fate and also The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide in America's Response.
Our next guest is Dr. Alfred DeZayas, professor of international law and former secretary of the United Nations Human Rights Committee for 22 years. Welcome to the show, Dr. DeZayas.
Good morning.
In face of all the documentations from the United States, Germany, France, Russia, and Great Britain, how is it that Turkey is still able to deny it?
Well, as you may know, the Ottoman Empire, the Sultan, did recognize it and did sign the Treaty of Sèvres in 1920. After the First World War, the Allies made it very clear that they were going to exact reparations from Turkey and that they were going to punish those who had engaged in genocide. This was recognized by the Sultan, and there were a number of trials taken that took place in Istanbul, in which numerous Turkish officials were convicted, and even three of them were convicted, sentenced to death, and executed. It is an anomaly that today the current Turkish government can deny the obvious and can deny the very reality of the genocide that took place in 1915 and 1916, because they themselves had recognized it also in the Turkish parliament. If you look at many of the speeches and resolutions, etc., in the Turkish parliament in 1919 and 1920, it was not questioned at that stage.
Does the fact that they offer bases, does this allow them to keep the denial?
Well, their policy changed in 1921-22. The Sultan was forced to resign. There was a new government, a nationalist government under Ataturk that took power, and they were not about to make any concessions. I mean, imagine what the consequences would have been. They did not want to see an independent Armenia emerge. As you may or may not know, the state of Armenia today is about one-tenth the size of the Armenia that the Allies, meaning the Brits and the Americans and the French, had envisaged. And the historical lands of Armenia in Turkey, in today's Turkey, these are rather large expanses of territory which the new Kemalist government was not about to give up. So they reemerged rather powerful, and the Allies did not feel like fighting another war in order to insist in the observance of the Treaty of Sèvres, and then they negotiated a new treaty, the Treaty of Lausanne of 1923, which did not insist on the punishment of the guilty and did not insist on return of the territory.
Do you have any advice to all cultures faced with these atrocities on how to pursue the recognition of genocide?
Well, the main thing is the right to truth. I mean, all peoples should demand historical truth. The question of prevention is, of course, of great relevance, and for that reason, it is that the United Nations, or rather the Secretary General, created the function of the Special Advisor on Genocide. That is Professor Juan Mendez, used to be Professor of Law at the University of Notre Dame, and his function, of course, is primarily early warning and, trying to ensure that something like this never again occurs. On the other hand, you still have the concern of those who did suffer genocide, the descendants of those who survived the genocide or those who didn't survive it, who do have a claim to their identity, a claim to their dignity, a claim to their history. And it is understandable that the Armenian communities in the United States and in France and elsewhere are clamoring 90 years after the beginning of the genocide for recognition as a first step toward reconciliation.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Dizayas.
Thank you for joining us on this Pacifica special, Genocide Remembered. This show was produced by myself and Lucy Dertavijian. Special thanks to Stan Mizrahi, Zuberry Fields, and Mansoor Buzz for engineering, recording, and editing.